Today we're pleased to have Douglas Scott. He got his PhD from Cambridge, did a postdoc at UC Berkeley, and is now a professor at the University of British Columbia. And today he's going to tell us about the quantum satellite.
Okay, thank you. This is on. Oh yeah, I can hear myself. Always a pleasure to visit the Perimeter Institute, so it's great to be here. Next time I come, I'll make sure it's not the winter, though. So is this the usual lighting configuration? Because that seems too light to me, but maybe I'm being picky.
You want it darker?
I want it darker, I think. There's like pictures in this, not just equations. So yeah, something like that is good.
As far as everything must be dark.
keep you in the dark. You can fall asleep and I won't know, and it's all good. I don't know everybody in the audience, obviously, so I don't know how much cosmology everybody knows. I see lots of people who are significantly younger than me, so some of them are presumably learning physics for the first time. So I'm going to give an introduction, a little tutorial on what the cosmic microwave background is and what we learn from it, before I say anything about new Planck results. So anybody who knows all that stuff, just bear with me or get your BlackBerries out and read your email or something, and then we'll come to some new Planck stuff eventually. So we're talking about this guy here, which is the whole sky as seen by Planck. So these are anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background. Okay, we're seeing them projected onto a sphere at some distance all the way around us. And it's the statistical properties of this pattern on the sky, which, you know, the press like to call the baby universe picture or something. It's the statistical description of these anisotropies that tell us the most about the universe we live in. This is the cleanest, highest signal to noise, easiest to understand physics and so on, probe of the standard cosmological model. So it's a fantastic thing the universe gives us to understand what the universe is. I don't know whether this is can't remember if this is projected inside out or outside in. This is part of the multiverse because there's all sorts of, there's several of these in the full thing. There's a shading over here, so obviously the main light source is in that direction. But other than that, I hope you sort of understand what's supposed to be pictured here. A brief summary of the history of the cosmic microwave background. This is the 50th anniversary of Penzias and Wilson's discovery paper. CMB was probably discovered in 1964, right? So it's same age as I am. I don't know if it's the same day, but that was a great day in the history of cosmology. And here's sort of the summary of the main things. And now we have Planck results, which is what I'm going to talk about. I'm very fortunate to be part of the Planck collaboration. Well, you want me to use, I don't do hockey. I am Canadian, but
since you're Canadian and talking about history,
yeah,
it's actually discovered about I think 15 years earlier at UBC or someone who was at or near UBC.
So the DAO, right, the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory, which is the old name, it's a fantastic name for a sort of empire,
right.
Building observatory, but it's now called the HIA or something. The guy called McKellar,
yeah, right.
Discovered these things, the absorption line, you can take the line ratio, and there's a 3 Kelvin.
Yeah.
So that's the Canadian version. You're completely correct, is that it was discovered in Canada first. Wasn't understood to be the CMB, of course. And it's the first of about half a dozen pseudo-discoveries of the CMB. It's a very complex, interesting scientific sociology story involving, you know, misunderstandings and misinterpretations of data and pigeon poop and all sorts of things, which if you want to get into that, we can do that over dinner or the bar or something. One of the things about the CMB is it's the most fantastic black body we know about. This is the cornerstone of the Hot Big Bang model. You can't make a better black body than that. You can't buy one. You know that the early universe was hot and dense and in thermal equilibrium from this guy here. there is no other, you know, early on there were other ideas involving dust and re-radiation and stuff, and all those ideas fell by the wayside. So we have this picture then, which is the hot Big Bang, which you can produce in a cartoon-like form like this, where you identify all the different epochs and the physical processes that are occurring at those epochs, with the modern day at the top here, and more speculative stuff indicated down the bottom. The CMB, we know, was last scattered in this area circled in green, which we call recombination, or the last scattering epoch. But the CMB photons were mostly created in particle annihilations, and ultimately derive from a phase way back here, which, if you like, is the last scattering epoch for gravitational waves or something. So if you study the CMB anisotropies in enough detail, you can learn about the whole history of the universe, including, in principle, inflation or whatever happened in the very early universe to make the perturbations. And the reason you can do this is because you have this fantastically high fidelity, high sensitivity map of the entire sky. And I'm sure, you know, everybody in this audience realizes this is a projection of the whole sphere onto a plane, just like you do in an atlas. And, you know, and the galactic plane usually is in the middle and has been removed. Oh, you want me to? Sure, this guy here. No.
The red thingy.
The red thingy.
Red thingy, the middle.
Yeah, that's what I just did.
You don't get it?
No.
Kind of tough, that's very
tough. Charles Townes just died. Did people realize this? He's a fantastically famous physicist so lasers just don't work anymore. It's for the sick. We're done with lasers. Yeah, it's a very cheap joke at the expense of a fantastically influential, I mean, changed modern life entirely. By doing fundamental science, right?
But your laser isn't working.
Yeah. No, okay. By doing fundamental science and discovering things that nobody had knew would be exciting and important, which is a lesson for people who fund science. But in any case, back to the, what was I talking about? The microwave background. So this is the whole sky. I like to at least quickly do this analogy because it helps people, I think, understand maybe a little more about what's going on. You know, here we are, and as you look out back in time and further away, you're looking out in redshift. This is the last scattering surface that I've colored in a sort of CMB color scheme. The Big Bang is some infinitely distant, or in some coordinate representation, a finite distance away. And the Big Bang is everywhere all around us. And we can learn by studying what's happening where the photons last scattered, we can learn about the interior of the acoustic cavity. And you can contrast that with the sun. So this is sometimes called the cosmic photosphere, where, you know, here's the center of the sun or some other star. The interior is ionized. It's neutral out here where we are. This is the scattering surface, which is called the photosphere. People study modes on the surface and radially in stars. You look at the frequencies of those modes, and that tells you about the physics of the interior of the cavity, in particular the sound speed and how it varies with density and temperature and radius and so on. And we're doing exactly the same thing with the CMB. We look at the squares of the amplitudes of these modes, and we see this acoustic harmonic structure. And by studying that in detail, we're learning about the interior of the acoustic cavity. And the interior of this acoustic cavity is the universe at early times before the last scattering epoch. But it really is exactly the same physics, which I think helps you understand a little more about, what you're seeing here, pressing the wrong button. So the CMB sky is, you know, the same temperature in all directions, about 2.7255 Kelvin. If you subtract that off, there's a dipole, which I probably won't have time to talk about today. And then you see these anisotropies. Just to give you a little of a flavor of that, there's real math and detailed statistical analysis goes on here. You can expand the sky in spherical harmonics, so that it should be familiar to any, you know, to anybody in the world who's taken an advanced quantum mechanics course, which is probably most of the people in this room. But the monopole is the overall temperature. The dipole tells us our motion relative to the CMB frame. And the higher order multiples tell us about the perturbations. You can average over the m's because there's no special direction. And then this quantity here is the power at each L. And therefore, a quantity that's L times L squared times CL is the power per decade in L. And that's usually the thing that's plotted. So when you see these plots, which I'll show you in a second, it's this power per decade in L versus L, which is like 1 over angle. And large angular scales, large angular scales are like smoothing the map with a big filter, and then you're picking up only the low L's. Intermediate angular scales, small angular scales where you can't even see the stuff because the pixels aren't enough pixels in this image. And then you put them all together and you get this. But we do it at every L. And if you cut the sky, the L's are a bit correlated and you have to take that into account. And there's stuff gets in the way that you have to deal with and so on. But the basic idea is that individual hot and cold spots don't really tell you anything. The anisotropies look fantastically Gaussian. That's the most random thing you can have. And that means that the only information in the map really is the two-point statistics or the variance as a function of angular scale. So all the information is in the variance. And then the shape of that variance is a function of angular scale, or in reciprocal space, the power spectrum is a function of spherical harmonic, carries almost all the information that's on the CMB sky. And the reason that that's good is because you can run theoretical codes which are very well controlled and have uncertainties when you compare codes at the sort of 0.01% level. I mean, very, very precise codes in which if you just put in the cosmological parameters and see how the spectrum varies, these are just very nice small movies from my old friend Martin White. These are back in the days when you could make movies that were like 3K, and then they don't crash your computer, right, ever. So the green line is just showing increasing a particular parameter. Here is baryons, right? Regular matter, here's dark energy, here's the tilt of the initial conditions, which is doing this. And you're not supposed to see details here, but you're supposed to be able to see that these three parameters do three different things to the spectrum. And obviously, other parameters will do other different things. So if there's enough signal to noise in this spectrum, given that it has lots of interesting structure in it, you should be able to measure many parameters at the same time. So unlike a lot of other tests in cosmology where there's basically a power law or two power laws or something, there's not actually very much information required to fit that. This is complicated, and the physics is very well understood, so we can measure these parameters. So just to give you an understanding of how this goes for Planck in terms of how you get from the raw data to cosmological parameters, there are trillions of bits of data come down from the spacecraft. Those are reduced into billions of measurements at these 9 frequencies. That gives you maps that have something like 50 million pixels over the whole sky. You can reduce those maps to something like 2 million YLM modes. The spectrum that's measured has something like 1,000 sigma in it. But that 1,000 sigma worth of structure is measured by about 6 parameters, right? And if if 5 sigma is good, then every 25 in sigma squared is good. So how many 25s are in 1,000? So there's how many 25s in 1,000? Can I do that math in my head? 40, right? Is that right? 40. So you could imagine measuring 40 5 sigma parameters if you were just a phenomenologist. Right? But in fact, 6 parameters works perfectly well. You've already fantastically compressed the data by assuming that it's Gaussian, right? Which goes all the way down to just the power spectrum containing everything, which is a hugely simplifying data compression. And then you've gone from 1,000-ish sigma to only requiring 6 parameters, which is also surprising. So there's no real evidence.
Much more than 40, because you have to square it. So if you want 25 for each parameter, then there will
be. Maybe I'm not doing that right.
So it's, I think it's much better than.
Okay, so I wasn't. Yeah, okay. So this just proves to you that you can't do mental arithmetic in your head while giving a talk. So don't even try. But fortunately, I have friends in the audience who will correct me whenever I make mistakes.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Anyway, no evidence for a seventh parameter. But then this is the point in the talk. If this was a public talk, somebody would, you know, I would be really proud of myself, the six parameters. And somebody would say, what are the six parameters? And I would go, can we just move on? And the six parameters that describes the universe. So the problem is that the six parameters are a bit esoteric. And the reason for that is because they're the six parameters that are most directly measured. They're the things that pop out most obviously from the codes that do the calculations. So they are these parameters, and this is the 2013 results here. And they have these kinds of names, which doesn't really help, right? So it's the baryon density, what do baryons mean? It's the CDM density, why is there an H squared in here? It's the sound horizon over the angular diameter distance, what the hell does that mean? Why is there an MC in here, right? Reionization optical depth, you know, that's not even really a parameter. It's just astrophysics or something. Slope of the initial conditions and the amplitude of the initial conditions. So I sort of rewrite it in this form so it's a little more helpful. But it's still a bit confusing, right? But I'm not giving a public talk here, but I'm just trying to explain to you that it's sometimes quite hard to. So the awesome thing is, as Nayesh points out, you would expect to be able to measure a lot of parameters, but six parameters works really well, and that's amazing. Nobody would have written down that, you know, that was the way the universe was going to be. So that's an astonishing simplification that the universe has for us. But then, unfortunately, it's hard to explain to lay people. But there you go. And then on top of that, we actually spend a lot of time talking about other parameters, which are just derived, right? They're not. So once you've set these six parameters, you can figure out, you know, the age of the universe of this thing called sigma 8, which is a measure of the amplitude of structure on the scale of clusters of galaxies, or the Hubble constant, or the individual omegas without the little h, and so on. So those are the six parameters, and you know they're well measured. N is clearly, you know, is not one, which is really exciting for motivating that we can maybe genuinely understand something about the early universe. There's optical depth is not very well measured, but it seems to be measured. And some of these, like this guy here, you know, is fantastically well measured, right? The signal to noise there is 1500 or something. So that's the thing that slides the perturbations back and forward. So the main message from Planck then is that this six-parameter model continues to fit. We call that standard lambda CDM. So we have a fairly precise model for the whole universe. But then you can ask, you know, where did these parameters come from? Why is there six and not seven? Although there's six parameters, there's a set of assumptions, you know, for building the model on which these six parameters live. So you could also ask about the assumptions and so on. So the assumptions I've written down here, this is my list. So you're basically assuming all of this stuff, and I leave you to read this for yourself. And then within that framework, you need these six parameters. All of these assumptions are testable, okay, and many of them have no reason to be definitely correct. They're a simplification, so you can, you know, the dark matter can be cold dark matter with a small cross section that makes a difference. The neutrinos could have, you know, freaky properties or, right, degeneracies or things, right? The dark energy doesn't have to be exactly cosmological constant and so on. So, you know, some of these, changing them would be great. You know, having physics completely different in some other part of the universe is probably crazier than some of the other one. But you can change all of this stuff. So some of this could be wrong, right? But in any case, you end up with, within that framework, which is the standard cosmological picture, you need six parameters. And here, this is Planck plus, this is WMAP polarization, high L data from ACT and SPT experiments, and barium acoustic oscillation data. So here we are with the six parameters, you know, what have we learned? And this is the point in the talk where it's like, you know, can I explain these parameters in a different way? Can I have fun with the parameters, right? So we wrote this paper, and I found this picture of, I don't know who that is. Who is that? So can you, you know, can you have fun with these parameters and do some other stuff with them? So I wrote this paper with Don Page, who's a physicist in Alberta, and Ali Naramani, who did most of the work, who's my student, and Jim Zibin, who did a bunch of the discussing with us, but refused to be associated with the paper because it was too silly. So I put his name in brackets. So you can talk about the other, you know, you can talk about the parameters and what values you get. So let me just have a bit of fun for a minute here. The age of the universe, if you put it in SI units, is about 0.4 exaseconds. It's about 10 to the 8 over alpha years, if you like the fine structure constant. It's about, I mean, Don really likes this one. It's 5 times 200, 200 octaves, right? So 5 times 2 to the 200 Planck times. It's about 5 trillion days, and it's almost exactly 3 times the age of the Earth, right? None of these have any significance, I think, but you know, there's theorists here who like to write papers on things that aren't always entirely sensible. So you know, I encourage you to. You can have fun with other parameters. I don't remember what I stuck up in here. Hubble constant. Hubble constant times the age of the universe is slightly less than 1. It used to be exactly consistent with 1, which is a sort of joke the universe plays on you because you tell students that 1 over the Hubble constant is an approximate estimate for the age of the universe because the universe has been decelerating and accelerating. And it turned out, you know, a few years ago, if you worked out the number, it was exactly what 1 over the Hubble constant was the age of the universe, which means that the accelerating part and the decelerating part exactly compensate for each other. So if you draw a straight line from now back to the origin, you get, you know, you get the age of the universe. But now it's not exactly true that H naught T naught is 1. But actually H naught T naught is consistent with N. And that is a thing that I invite theorists. You don't even have to, I don't need to be a co-author. You can just acknowledge me, right? If you have a theory for explaining that, right? H times T will be unity in about a billion years. The final value, the Hubble constant, will be about 56. So as you know, as I said last, the old joke is Sandage got it right, but he was a few billion years ahead of his time. But young people don't know who Sandage was. So. Trying to remember what else is stuck in here. Yeah, the critical density turns out to be, so the critical density for matter, for everything, is about 5 nucleons per cubic meter. And in round number, you know, in integer numbers of nucleons per cubic meter, this is the correct number today. And this is easy to remember for somebody who has a sense of humor, because you know, if you know anything about nucleosynthesis, that there are no nucleons of mass number 5. So you just need to remember that. And that's what the universe has per cubic meter, just to play a little trick on you, and then you can remember. So if you want to impress people at parties, that's Douglas Adams said physicists don't get invited to the right sorts of parties. And that's probably why. Lambda in appropriate units is 10 square attohertz. Don really likes this because it's not numbers, it's just words. So you can, and it's, you know, and it's actually accurate, right? The distance to the last scattering is about 400 yotta meters. The photon numbers within the entire scattering volume, which is basically the total number of known kinds of particles in the whole universe, is actually very close to alpha to the minus 42. So that appeals both to fine structure constant fans and Douglas Adams fans. And it's a number you can try to remember. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that I've written down here. I won't go through it, but we submitted this, submitted it several places, actually, who said, I really enjoyed reading this, but it's not appropriate for my journal because it's too flippant, right? And like, it's we're a serious physics journal and so on. So it's in Physics in Canada. Right? So anybody who's a member of CAP, we'll have go back to the recycling bin and take out
take out the last issue of Physics in Canada, because it's quite a funny article towards the end of that, which I encourage you to read. The reason that we can have all this fun is because we're living in the precision cosmology era. This is fantastic. So, I mean, I remember the days when we were arguing about, well, whether we'd measured anything on this plot, and then whether we'd measured anything that looked like peaks, and then where the peaks were, and then so on. There are now, you know, at least 8 or 9 peaks on this plot alone, and then there's temperature, polarization, cross-correlation, and polarization, polarization. There's at least 18 acoustic peaks now in the combined sum of the three power spectra. So there's no question that this is sound waves, and the universe reionized at low redshift, but was ionized at redshifts above 1,000, and the basic picture is just has to be correct. You know, nobody has a completely different idea that does any kind of calculation that comes anywhere close. Okay, so that was the brief introduction. Where are we? I have about 5 minutes left. Let me talk about Planck. Here's Planck on the launch pad, along with the Herschel satellite. Launched on time and worked essentially flawlessly. There's a whole bunch of Planck papers, so I spend a lot of my time editing Planck papers. Like last night, I was up pretty late because we're about to release a whole bunch of new papers. So there were, you know, papers before launch. There were early results that had nothing to do with cosmology. There's a whole series of papers in between the data releases. 2013 data release produced 31 papers, and the new data release is going to have, you know, it's a similarly large number of papers. There's a whole bunch of topics that Planck has a bearing on. Not all of them are cosmology. There are people, you know, for cosmologists, there's all the muck in the way that you throw in the dustbin, and people go to the dustbin and go, oh, right, you know, fantastic. In fact, some of the newest, coolest results from Planck for things that nobody had thought about are actually to do with the physics of the turbulent magnetic interstellar medium, which is a complicated physics problem on its own, but not cosmology, right? But in fact, you know, you could give a whole other talk on that. What is the coolest result?
Why?
I really like the aberration thing, but that's just me, right? I like the fact that we have measured that the spots on one side of the sky are bigger than the spots on the other side of the sky because we're moving through. So that's cool. The ISM results, the spinning dust is really cool. There are dust grains that we now believe which are spinning billions of times a second. If you're teaching an upper level E&M classical electromagnetism course and talking about the Larmor formula and all that stuff, then this is the perfect example. There are these little spinning dipoles which are giving off dipole radiation because that peaks at gigahertz because they're spinning at gigahertz. That's really cool. And then there's a bunch of stuff to do with magnetic fields, which we could talk about separately, which gets in the way of doing cosmology. So you really got to understand that stuff if you want to do the cosmology. Planck is at the second Lagrange point of the Earth-Sun system. It goes around the Sun in the same time that the Earth does. A little bit of extra gravity is, you know, there's a special point where that's true. Does more or less great circle scans in the sky, so about every 6 months it has a map of the entire sky. The data release from 2013 from the two instruments contained the first sky survey from about the first 6 months, the second sky survey, and a little bit of a third one. The new data release, HFI, continued going for essentially 5 complete sky surveys before the cryogens ran out. LFI continued for 8 sky surveys, and you've only seen this much so far. So the total amount of data is increasing dramatically. And the reason that, you know, we have all of these different things is when you go around the sky every 6 months and then 6 months later, you see that you're sort of upside down, if you like. So the beams in odd surveys and even surveys are quite, quite different. So systematics checks between odd and even surveys are very important. Systematics checks between years are also important. And we changed the phase angle of the precession where the satellite nods up and down a little bit. We changed the phase angle after 4 surveys by 90 degrees. So for LFI, there's sort of three sets of two different things. You know, there's 2 to the 3, which is why we got funding to do 8 surveys and then stopped.
the Planck sensitivity numbers that we have in black here are pretty much equal to or better in all cases than the ones that were in the book, the so-called blue book that was published just before Planck was all coming together, and similar to what was in the red book, which was the really optimistic scenario in the very early days. So Planck, it's a space experiment. Space experiments, if they work, really work. So Planck, has delivered exactly what was planned to be delivered, which is why you go to space. The current data release then contains much more data. There's lots of extra work on calibration and beams and so on, the things that are, sound really dull, but it's exactly what you have to get right in order to do precision cosmology. What has changed? Not very much, in fact, is lambda CDM still, it continues to be a very good fit. The universe is still very flat, and there's some changes to the parameters, but you gotta care about an individual parameter to really care. But I know some people do care because it's what they do for a living, right? The Hubble constant or something. Right? So, one of the things that has changed is the calibration. The reason for that is the best calibration to use is what's called the orbital dipole, and that's the fact that the CMB dipole changes as you go around the sun. And that change is exactly known to many, many digits because we know exactly how fast we're going around the sun. So if you can measure the changing dipole, you have the perfect calibration. So in the last data release, we hadn't quite got that sorted out yet. So instead, we calibrated to the WMAP cosmological dipole, not a time-changing one. This time we've measured, right, the orbital dipole, so we can calibrate that to the number that it's supposed to be, and that means that we can now measure our own CMB dipole. So there's a new CMB dipole, which is pretty much consistent with WMAP, but has changed a little bit. Okay, this is the sort of first of the roughly, one sigma or a fraction of a sigma changes that are being reported in 2015. And it's a contest is to see which one of you is the first person to ask about a one sigma change in the data. And there's a special prize. You'll see what the prize is when you ask the question. There's a special prize for the first person to do that. So this is just discussing the calibration. The calibration has changed by all in the maps by something slightly less than 1%, and therefore in the power spectra by twice that. So the main thing that you'll notice is a change in the parameter A sub S, which is the overall scaling. And for most people, the precise value of A sub S doesn't matter because it's not predicted in most theories. Right? So, but that is the biggest change. We have new maps, and of course, at this resolution, you can't tell that these maps are any different than the old maps, but I promise you these are the new maps. There's also polarization maps, so this is 30 gigahertz and 44 gigahertz from LFI, 70 gigahertz from LFI, and then the 353 gigahertz, which is a really good dust monitor, HFI's highest frequency polarized channel. And what I'm not showing you here, and you will not see in gory detail in the 2015 release, are the polarization maps at the so-called CMB channels of HFI. And the reason is because we're still working on those because polarization is really, really hard. So there will be limited polarization information coming out, but for the full polarization, you'll have to wait. It's worth emphasizing that these maps are really awesome quality. And the reason that's worth emphasizing is because no matter how many times you say this to people who don't do the CMB for a living, people are used to looking at pictures that have interesting structure in them, in which most of the information is contained in phase correlations. And the CMB is not like that. So the information is in the two-point function, so it looks like noise, right? But it's the fact that it's not, it's much bigger variance than the noise is that carries the information. So in order to see that, here's a map from Planck centered around the North Ecliptic Pole at 70 gigahertz with the LFI instrument. And here's the same map at 100 gigahertz from the HFI instrument. Okay, so just flicking between these, you can see they're almost identical once you're away from the plane. These are scaled so that the CMB would be the same. So any changes in here is because the foregrounds have a different spectrum. So then you can take the difference, and this is the real noise level in these maps, right? So there's almost no noise in these maps. They're almost noise-free, even though they look like noise. So don't be fooled. And just in case there's anybody here from the other hemisphere, let me do the South Ecliptic Pole. And again, it's, you know, it's exactly the same story. Okay, so that's part of comparing these frequencies, is why Planck has 9 frequency channels, because you can remove the foregrounds the best by having as many channels as you can, including low frequency ones and high frequency ones. And so we can extract, you know, the best CMB map and then all these different kinds of foreground stuff. And we can play the same games in polarization. This is a low frequency polarization template and a high frequency polarization template. So mostly synchrotron and mostly dust. When you've done all of that, you can take the power spectrum of the CMB map. And this is the 2013 result, where this is the thing I've described before. And this is these are the residuals compared to the red line. And if I go to the 2015 one, you can see, well, first of all, you see the calibration difference. But then if you start looking in detail, you'll see that the noise improves dramatically, right? I mean, it doesn't just improve, it improves a lot. So you can see that you can do much better statistics on the 2015 data than the 2013 data. And you can do the same for the temperature E-mode polarization power spectrum and the EE polarization power spectrum, where the red line plotted on here is the one derived from temperature. So it basically tells you that the polarization data are confirming the same picture that the temperature data are confirming. And you can do that separately at the parameter level by plotting. In some sense, it doesn't really matter that you can't read this, because these are contours from temperature only and then contours from throwing in polarization. And nothing really shifts. So the polarization basically confirms, tightens the error bars, not dramatically, because polarization is much weaker. We're not cosmic variance limited for very much of the polarization power spectrum. It tightens the parameters, but is a fantastic consistency check. If you're interested in detailed parameters, you know, here's parameters from TT, here's parameters from TT plus TE plus EE, and there really aren't very big shifts that you should be excited about. So, I'm not going to look at that for very long. So the uncertainties are reduced by, you know, 25% or something. There is this change in the calibration. One of the 1 sigma changes that some people are...
Sorry, this is compared to 2013 or with or without polarization?
This is compared to 2013. Yeah, you're right. And this is compared to 2013. And this is compared to 2013. So the whole slide must be compared to 2013. No, there was three of them.
That sounds quite a large correction.
Which one? Yeah, no, so it's bigger than the error bars that represent it. And there's a very long and very boring, complicated story, which is not. You would like somebody to just say, oh, we did this wrong or something, and then it would, but it's a long, complicated story. Which have the same sign, more or less, it turns out. Wrapped up in that is the additional complication that we are now using our dipole, which is not WMAP's dipole. So a reasonable fraction of the difference between WMAP and Planck is because of a different dipole. So that's in some sense apples and oranges or something, right? Right. So it's not just that we shifted by 2%. It's part of that is that the calibration, the thing we're calibrating to, has changed slightly. I don't know if that makes sense. Could not calibrate off our own dipole before, so we calibrated off the WMAP dipole, which you know, brought the calibration down compared to what we now think the dipole is, even though the dipole is only about 1 sigma different with WMAP's error bars on the dipole, right? and it is
only one dipole.
WMAP measured a dipole.
Yes.
Our dipole measurement is 1%. One sigma different than theirs within their error bars, right? Uh-oh.
haircut.
You have to do this because now we're gonna see all your appointments in a minute.
Yeah.
So the shift is more than one sigma from Planck's error bar on the dipole, right? So it's just basically there's nothing very exciting going on here. Calibration is hard. Calibrating at 0.1% is really, really hard. People have worked fantastically on, WMAP people and Planck people got together and they would love to have found that the other guys just screwed up. And it's not that simple. Okay. Are you going to ask about one sigma changes in parameters?
No.
Okay.
So there was this difference between the Planck 2013 results and the reanalysis done by Spergel and co. And they blamed it on something in 2017, but the new Planck results are blaming it on something else. Is that the same thing? Are those things that are different?
I don't want to diss my colleagues from Princeton and so on, but but they didn't have access to all the data. There were things that they said which were correct. There were things they said that don't make any sense.
Is this one of the things that you guys have fixed in this round?
It's way more complicated story than that, which I will get into later. I really don't want to know the details, probably. But if you do, I can tell you some of the details later. But no, it's not that we said, oh, right, okay, we didn't do that, we'll just fix that. So it's nothing like that, right? We understood at the time and responded to that paper explaining how there are things they said which are correct and things they said which are not correct. Story they tried to paint about how simple the difference is and how to reconcile with WMAP is not the story. That's probably enough to say about it. If I say any more, I'll start and I'm being recorded, right? So something that I don't mean to. I've been diplomatic so far, which is extremely difficult for me. For some people this is a big deal. So the optical depth from reionization now is about some number like 0.07, or depends exactly what parameter combinations you use, because the error bar isn't small on that. That means that, you might have thought that means that sigma 8 comes down a bit when you think about it, but because the calibration changed, actually sigma 8 is pretty much the same as it was before. So N has increased a little bit, right? The worst thing Planck could have done was measured that N was 1. So that was my nightmare, right? So N has increased a little bit towards 1, but the error bar has come down. So it's still 5 sigma from 1. So it's still good, right? There's no evidence that the universe was just created. And there's nothing we can do to understand it. Omega baryons increased a little bit. There's limits on all of these different things, which I'll talk a little bit about going fast in the rest of the talk. One of the cool things from Planck that I think nobody had ever really thought very clearly through before is CMB lensing. So I think when people were writing the proposals for Planck, people realized that the CMB would be lensed and that you could in principle measure it. But nobody had really figured out how to do it, right? So there's a guy called Smith, right, who wrote a paper with some other people figuring out how to extract lensing from noisy data, and that changed the whole landscape, and it was actually doable. It's very difficult to do carefully and involves a lot of computation, analytic and numerical computation, but we are now able to extract from higher order correlations in the CMB map, we're able to extract the lensing potential of the entire universe, and the new Planck result is about 40 sigma, which I'll show you in a second. And this is a thing which has not been fully exploited because it still hasn't quite got into everybody's consciousness, I think, that this is a new thing that we know about the universe. People work on lensing on small scales, but not on these large scales. It is very useful as an additional constraint on things like modified gravity models, because it tells you about the universe at redshifts like a couple that the CMB otherwise does not do. So that map looks something like this, right? This map, just to put it in perspective, particularly for the older people, this map is a similar signal-to-noise level map as the COBE map that we had of the CMB that was the holy grail of physics and the result of the century or whatever various people said at the time. It was about signal-to-noise of 1 per pixel or something. So this is similar. Right? So this isn't, you know, fantastically high fidelity and so on, but it's 40 sigma. Right? So there are models that would fit this and models that don't fit this. So this is a big deal from Planck. You can work out the power spectra of that, and there's, you know, you can compare 2015 to 2013. We're doing much better now. And that's mainly, you know, people like Kendrick working hard on understanding how the data works and how to correct for biases and so on. And here we are, right, with this 40 sigma detection. One of the things that gives you is an independent check on the amplitude, right? So you know, here's Planck lensing plus Baryon acoustic oscillations, Planck lensing plus Baryon acoustic oscillations plus a constraint on this parameter that slides the anisotropies back and forward, and you can see it's all sort of consistent with the Planck temperature constraints. So you do need a high value of sigma 8, and that is confirmed by the lensing, and the lensing is essentially consistent with the rest of the story. Another thing that you can do from the lensing is that you can pull out B modes, right? So this is a continuation of that cross-correlation study, is to realize that if you have the E modes and you have the lensing map, you can construct how much of the E modes will leak into B modes. So you can make a fake B mode map, and you can cross-correlate that with your really noisy actual B mode map to try to estimate the B mode. So this was first done in an SPT paper by Hansen et al. The same basic analysis was applied to Planck. So these red points here are the lensing B mode power spectrum estimate from Planck using this cross-correlation analysis. These two sets of points here, one of them is, you know, bicep and the other one is polar bear here. These are the total B mode. So you're not really supposed to plot, you know, this and this on the same plot, but here it is on the same plot, right? And this is measuring the total B mode. This is only measuring the lensing B mode. So the fact that this is here says nothing about primordial B modes, right? This is just the lensing B mode. But we can do this.
So isn't it like just a convoluted thing to compute? You have a lensing map. From that, you can predict B mode.
Yeah.
So that, if that's the point, so that can
just... No. Then we have a B mode map. It's just very noisy.
Right, but it's the same data set, but it was just, you get the lensing map.
The B mode map was not used to make the lensing map.
But use polarization. You didn't use polarization to make the lensing map?
You could, but you don't need that, right?
Okay, you
so, you, I mean, the you can just use temperature alone. It's got most of the weight, right? So if you like, use temperature alone, four-point function or whatever, right, to get the lensing map. You get the E mode map. You make a fake B-mode map, you take the actual B-mode map, and the actual B-mode map itself, you couldn't detect the B-modes in because it's too noisy, but by cross-correlating it with where you think the B-mode peaks and so on are, you can pull it out.
So I guess you say you understand your polarization well enough.
Yeah. I mean, it's essentially the same thing people do to measure ISW, which you have written papers on. So. I think.
I wouldn't trust myself.
Okay. It's just a cross-correlation technique. So here is optical depth, right? Here, you know, here's where we were before. We had a bigger error bar. No, so more or less, no matter what you do, even if you take the W map and you make a slight cleaning using the high-frequency polarization, you get a lower optical depth than before. But as I said, it's kind of one sigma lower. And if you're really excited by that, you don't have anything interesting to work on, I would say. But it's not going to stop people working on it. So the answer is, you know, somewhere between 0.6 and 0.06 and 0.08, depending exactly what kind of error bar you want and so on. If you combine with baryon acoustic oscillations, you get fantastic consistency checks of physics, right? So it really works also at low redshift. So then you can combine the baryon acoustic oscillations, knowing that it's consistent with the Planck data, to break this degeneracy. So this is the omega lambda omega matter plane. Dashed line is flat. The CMB alone wants you to be along here. But if you combine with BAO, you have to be up here. So then the constraint on curvature now is just fantastic, right? Coincidentally peaks at zero. But that's just a coincidence. But it's now 95% limit on curvature is 0.5%. Right, so we're well within 1% of being not flat, okay. Which, so if you were like me last week trying to teach undergraduates about non-Euclidean geometry, then you do this, and then there's always somebody says, hold on a minute, what the hell were you talking about for the last three lectures when the universe is in fact Euclidean? And then you say, well, you know, you can't do this test unless you know how it behaves if it's not Euclidean. And they go, give me that. So it's very hard to convince people that you need to think about not flat universes anymore. There are some possible tensions here. So the weak gravitational lensing definitely does not fully agree so if you try and throw that in, then you can do stuff like, if I make a model of dark energy like this, and I throw in, Planck plus a bunch of other stuff, but if I do Planck plus weak lensing, it pulls the fit down to somewhere here. Error bars are pretty big, so it's, you know, only just slightly outside this 95% contour. But nevertheless, if you combine data sets, completely different data sets, which are not fully consistent, then you can infer, you know, that the dark energy isn't just cosmological constant or something. And this is very dangerous to do. Individual well-controlled data sets are one thing, but just throwing in any old other data set is difficult. But I guarantee there will be papers on that stuff, right? That was a 2-sigma difference, so people were allowed to ask about that, but nobody did. So I scared them all off. That's good. There's no doubt that lambda CDM, the Planck data, want high sigma 8. So gravitational lensing and some estimates from clusters want a smaller amplitude. And if you take that difference seriously again, you could infer, for example, something to do with neutrinos. And people have written already a lot of papers on that. I would, you know, maybe we're learning about neutrinos, but we're probably learning that the experimental data is still discrepant for some reason that we haven't fully understood. You can, however, study neutrinos, and if you're, you know, relatively conservative about the data that you combine, then you certainly get very interesting constraints. This is, for example, the Hubble parameter versus the sum of the neutrino masses, color-coded with sigma 8. And you can see if you add BAO and stuff, you're here. This dashed line is the minimum neutrino mass. So we're getting really pretty close. So a combination of CMB data and large-scale structure data and stuff in the next few years will measure this parameter, almost certainly. Whether people that work on real neutrinos, right, will believe that that's a real measurement is another thing, right? But there will be a battle because this is coming, and probably the best way to measure the sum of the neutrino masses. So we're really getting pretty close. You can look at consistency with the rest of physics. So here's nucleosynthesis, right? Provided that you're relatively conservative about which other experiments that you believe, then there's pretty good consistency. So then you can use that to constrain, you know, early universe physics and so on. There are lots of numbers to do with inflation. So I'm not going to go through all of these, but if you're interested, you can find these slides somewhere on the internet, and this is being recorded anyway. You can make new joint parameter constraint plots from 2015. All the error bars shrink a little bit. You can look at N sub S. You can look at constraints on tensors, and you get numbers which are, you know, around 0.1. And this is without using BISAP. So there is a note on here which says, you know, as lots of people said, you know, Planck put out a paper talking about high latitude dust that had implications for BISAP. Lots of people said it would be really good if people could analyze these data sets together. Can't the teams just work together? So we did that. So this is, you know, I think this is a thing we can be genuinely proud of. You know, it's hard to reconcile certain countries in the world. We'll never sit at the same table. But it is actually possible in science for reasonable human beings to say, okay, the way to do this is to actually do it together. So we shared the data at full discussions. There's separate analyses with lots of interaction to sort stuff out. You know, people would like to find that the other guys had messed stuff up and so on. So there's lots of, you know, lots of criticism in a reasonable scientific way. And then we end up understanding what we think is going on, and we have a consistent story. So there is a joint paper which uses Planck plus BISAP and also some of the Keck data in the BISAP 2 field. That paper, I'm allowed to tell you, has been submitted to a journal. It has not been submitted to the archive, but will be submitted to the archive imminently. And that's all I'm allowed to tell you. So if you were hoping to hear, about that paper, then at least you've heard that it's been submitted to a journal. So it's a little piece of information. But you know, which means it's finished and the teams agree, right? I mean, it was a very, very fruitful collaboration. And as I say, it's a thing. I think, you know, as scientists, we can be proud of the fact that we can do things like this that don't always happen in the rest of the world. Right? You can put constraints on other parameters using the same usual plot and these joint things. You can see that, you know, this is a measure of isocurvature. You can't really have very much isocurvature. It all looks pretty adiabatic.
Go back.
I am, but your computer's being slow.
So is ms squared phi squared rule that now? It's the black line, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's still pretty close. I mean, you know, it's the glass half empty, glass half full thing.
Outside the two sigma region.
So the question is, what about the independent R constraint? So that is, in principle, an additional constraint. So the question is, does M squared, with the joint paper, does M squared phi squared look good or not?
That's okay.
So I think that's the thing, assume that you're waiting for.
But no, so, I'm just looking there, it looks like M squared phi squared outside, so.
No, it's definitely a little bit worse for an M squared phi squared than before, but it's not ruled out at seven sigma, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, so if you're a big fan of M squared phi squared, it's still just about good, right? So that's the, I'm just about finished here. So you can also try and fit features. There's a sort of thing going on at low L. You can invent models which have more. You can either parameterize in the initial power spectrum, or in V of phi, or in CL, and there's different games you can play. But whatever you do, if you go from just a straight line, right, which has two parameters, an amplitude and a slope, to something with a feature, you need three more parameters. So there's a position for the feature, there's a kind of width of the feature, and there's a height of the feature. So the fit has to be significantly better for the data to require that fit, given that there's three more parameters. And there just isn't enough non-power law stuff going on that you know, a model with three more parameters is a sufficiently better fit. You know, so one of these models is a better fit, but it's not better enough. So that's the bottom line there. You know, which is not, you know, shouldn't stop people working on, you know, if you had a theory that made an explicit prediction and it fits, then that's a different story, right? We don't have to search over all these parameters. So there's still motivation for people to work on such things. So base lambda CDM continues to be a good fit, including polarization. There's no convincing evidence for any simple extensions to base lambda CDM. There's some tensions remain with some of the astrophysical data, in particular sigma 8. Planck constraints on R are pretty much the same as they were in 2013, a little bit tighter, but not very much. Ang's changed a little bit, so it changes that plot that Niash got excited about. Scalar fluctuations are consistent with purely adiabatic and so on. So let me just finish by saying, you know, the 2015 data release is, well, first of all, the joint paper will be out imminently, shortly after that. And we're talking about, you know, fairly soon, but I mean, even if I had a date for you, we haven't stuck to several of the other dates, so the answer is it's definitively October 2014. Right? So we're already past. Polarization is just very, very difficult. And it's not difficult from a, oh my God, we can't do this perspective. It's difficult from a, you know, oh my God, we have to deal with this extra systematic that we had no idea was going to be there. It's another month's work, guys, right? And then the thing that comes out of that feeds to everybody else who has to change everything, rerun all the codes and simulations, and the polarization is just very, very hard. It's a very weak signal. So that's the reason. It's not because we have fundamental problems with the data. We just have more work to do. There will be a whole bunch of papers And the full polarization release will be sometime later in 2015. I've rambled on long enough now. Let me just leave you with the slide to remind you that this was the work of not just people like me who kind of read papers and chat about experiments. It was, you know, people that built the experiments, people that work, lots of young people working really hard on analysis and running supercomputers into the ground and so on. And there's, you know, and there's a whole list of people, but including Canada. So let me finish there. Thank you. Neil.
So there was a paper from Frank maybe a year ago on the anomalies, so-called anomalies. Could you go through those briefly and just comment whether they have sharpened or gone away?
This is a plant. This is called a plant. So I'm like all the way through the talk and going, Neil, ask about the anomaly. There you go. So this is the joke slide, right? You need to worry about what particle physicists call the look elsewhere effect, and I would call it posteriori statistics, or doing the statistics right.
Your paper didn't quite say
so you need to be you need to be very careful.
Some of
that had already been said, so it wasn't really repeated very strongly in the 2013 paper.
Yeah, so okay, so now
and there's
more,
a big debate here.
So
let me not pretend that this isn't an area of dispute, because it is, because we're scientists and we argue about it. I mean, we argue for a living and have fun doing it. Right?
It has a sharper role.
So if you have a theory and that you might have had before, even although you didn't tell me about it, right? If you could convince me today that you have a theory which is so well motivated from some other purpose and predicts a certain thing, right? Then there are two or three sigma effects in the CMB sky.
So is the cold spot stronger or weaker?
So the cold spot is pretty similar, right? I mean, it really is there on the sky. Right? And then you have to ask yourself, right, what about hot spots? What about pairs of hot spots and cold spots? What about the size of the filter? What about the shape of the filter?
There's no change.
And what you know is that a three sigma result just goes away if I marginalize over stuff. Right? So if I'm allowed to marginalize over stuff, you have to be much more than three sigma to be excited. It's the reality. On the other hand, these are the largest scales in the universe. There's only one universe, so it's all you got. So if there's a little thing happening on the biggest scales, when it's just kind of happening, this is just kind of what you would see.
Okay, so
you certainly have to be open to the possibility. So you need to tell people about three sigma results. And people should go off and work on, you know, they should be motivated to work on stuff.
Nothing changed in those.
The numbers are not dramatically different for the cold. I mean, it hasn't gone away. It's there in the data.
Power spectrum asymmetry.
Our spectrum asymmetry is pretty much the same, but you have to choose an L max. Right? The power spectra is not asymmetric on one side of the sky than the other, because that would be obvious. Right? It's only asymmetric over a range of L's. That range of L's was not predicted beforehand. That range of L's is roughly the horizon size at last scattering, so it is a special scale. So it is worth telling people that, in principle, if you pick this particular test, there's a three sigma effect. So all these other tests you could have done, right? So you need to somehow, you know, be a little bit skeptical, but be open to the idea that it could be exciting. And that's a hard,
so have
it's
any
a hard line to
have
try.
Have any other anomalies emerged?
No anomalies.
Reduction in the noise, for example, other cold spots on smaller scales.
There's no other significant anomalies being discussed in the talks, the slides I would be allowed to show you. I can certainly say that. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, as I say, this is an area of vigorous debate, which is not good. It's what we do. So, you can ask me what I think personally, and that's a different question. I'm skeptical, right? But I've written papers trying to explain some of these anomalies. And I would definitely encourage other people to continue to work on that. One of the cool things is polarization. So hemispheric asymmetry, for example, if you saw the same asymmetry in the polarization on a similar scale in the same direction and so on, then you'd be in business. And if that was three sigma, it'd be really three sigma, because it's new information.
Can't you say something about that?
So we're working pretty hard on that. But as I say, polarization is difficult. Very large angle polarization is very difficult. So we are working actually very hard on that. And I would be delighted to find that the universe is genuinely asymmetric. That would be really cool. So, John.
It's Planck 2015 have new results from the matter first.
I mean, you predict the matter power spectrum based on these parameters, right? But you don't measure it directly. I mean, that's for galaxy surveys and Langevin surveys and so on.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like young people here who are presumably shy because they think I'm going to pick them.
So maybe you said this already. In the earlier stuff, there was a discrepancy in the amplitude between Planck and WMAP. Does this calibration that you redid resolve that? You know, people talk about 2.5%. I think it was just a scale.
So
has that gone away?
Calibration is the biggest thing. So now they're, but that was the slide I showed much earlier. Maybe it wasn't clear, but they're now fairly consistent.
Okay.
There's also discussions about parameters from slightly higher L and lower L shifting a little bit. I think it's relatively clear that those shift about as much as they should, given that there's different information and so on. So I don't think there are any significant differences between Planck and WMAP. There was definitely a calibration difference.
All right, and that's what you talked about the change.
Yeah. And as I said, the story for why that changed is it's not very satisfactorily simple. You can't write down a 20-word sentence which encapsulates what actually happened.
Can you tell us about the spinning dust part?
I genuinely, as a physicist, right, if I take my cosmologist hat off, that's really cool. So there's this stuff that peaks at tens of gigahertz, correlates with where the dust is on the sky, that looks a bit like synchrotron in terms of the spectrum, right? Except that if you work hard, you can see that if you remove synchrotron and dust, you end up with this bump. And this is exactly what people get in models of very rapidly spinning dust grains, where basically the dust grain is a little dipole. And it's giving off dipole radio. I mean, it's exactly a classical radio. It's just fantastic. And the reason that it peaks in the gigahertz range is because that's how fast it's spinning. Right? It's not, there's no, it's easy. It's easy physics.
It slowed down, shouldn't it?
There's just hardly any collisions in the interstellar medium, right?
It's giving off very quickly.
But that doesn't slow it down very fast. But in the lab they would just collide with something. You don't spin it a billion times a second for very long in the lab, right? So the question is, how do they spin up?
Yeah.
And there's differential torquing when the photons land, and they're not round. They're sort of fractal. They're big molecules, right? Or sort of. Well, we don't know what they are. We'd like to know what they are. But I think it's a great example for an introductory E&M course when you're first introducing the students to the concept, acceleration makes radiation, and you're looking for a really simple, here's the thing, and it's real. Right? And a lot, 5 or 10 years ago, people talked about this, but people thought somebody was just making stuff up, right, and hoping that this was true. But now it looks real. I think that's pretty.
What's the future of CMB cosmology? Should we aim for
Cosmic
variance on polarization, or should we do balloon borne to get the dust maps down, or should we all just give up and do 21 centimeter?
21 centimeter is really hard as well. It's the new CMB, but it's still a while away from being. There's a lot more information to plumb from the CMB, particularly in polarization. So some polarization information, as you know, is special, so the B-mode stuff, but also breaks some more parameter degeneracies, right? Because the last scattering surface for polarization is much thinner, so the peak structure is much better defined in it, right? So it constrains parameters in a different way. So there is a future in doing serious polarization, right? So getting to L of
3,000 or 4,000 for a large fraction of the sky in polarization. There's oodles more information there. So you will significantly constrain things like N and omega B H squared, obvious things, but then neutrino mass, several other extensions to this. So I think that's coming, right? But you know, building a simple polarization experiment to do large angle to get V modes and stuff, it's not clear what the target is. So it's not clear that there's a cheap, simple experiment that gets to the R value that would be. I mean, you need to get to R of 0.01 sensitivity, right, before you're interested. Because people are already building experiments that could do that. I don't know if that answers the question.
I mean, like specific experiments with the
pixie. So brand new Canadian experiment that does everything. That would be the best. Is there another question there or not?
Okay, if not, then let's thanks for your